Well, good evening. I'm opening my Bible to the book of Matthew, chapter 7. We're going to start there. Matthew chapter 7 will be a lot of different places tonight, but this is going to be at least our starting place for the lesson this evening. And as you turn to that passage, let me thank you so much for your presence. And your presence is not only an encouragement to me, but I'm sure it's an encouragement to the others here as you look around. And one of the things that all of this COVID stuff has taught to me is to never take for granted the opportunity that we have to be together as the people of God. During the first, I think it was about 6 or 8 weeks that we did Zoom, we did live stream kind of stuff. One of the things that you really miss, and then after going back and just being in the presence of our brothers and sisters, and that is such an important facet of who we are and what God wants us to be and to be doing. And I appreciate so much that you went ahead with this effort and that there's someone here tonight to study together. Back when I was a kid, that was long before. There were hundreds of channels, on-demand movies, and internet streaming. Most of you will remember that there were just 3 television networks. That was it. And one of those networks decided that it would be a good idea to broadcast a particular movie on an annual basis. It was a movie that had been released in 1939, starring a very young Judy Garland. And in 1959, CBS began airing The Wizard of Oz one Sunday night every year. And when I was young, my twin brother and I, that was something that we always looked forward to. The story of Dorothy, who is running away from home in order to protect her little dog Toto. She's sort of tricked into returning home by Professor Marvel. And as she is going home, she finds herself caught in the midst of a tornado. She can't get into the storm cellar, and so she takes refuge in her bedroom. She's hit in the head by a window sash that's flying through the air. And when she awakens, or so we're led to believe, her entire house, you remember, is up in the air, and it's spinning in the midst of the storm. The house eventually lands in Munchkin Land. She meets there Glinda, the Good Witch of the East, and she asks Glinda about how to get home, and Glinda says that but your only option is for you to seek help from the great and powerful Oz, but that's going to require a trip to the Emerald City. And it was at that point in the movie that Dorothy's a bit troubled, and she turns to Glinda and she says, but how do I start for the Emerald City? To which Glinda said, it's always best to start at the beginning. And all you do is follow the yellow brick road. Finding Emerald City, it was simply a matter of traveling on the right way. And in the process of her travels, Dorothy is going to encounter some new friends. She's going to have to overcome some rather sizable obstacles, one of them being the Wicked Witch of the West. But Dorothy's never going to get lost along the way. And it's not because she was so special. It wasn't because she was so wise. It wasn't due to the insight of her traveling companions. It's simply because that's where the yellow brick road would take her. And so as long as she stuck to that particular road, Oz was going to be where she ultimately would end up. Now, wouldn't it be great if there was a yellow brick road that would lead us to a destination that most, if not all of us, are hoping for? A fulfilling life, a satisfying marriage, a blessed family, a deeper relationship with God, but most especially, a home in heaven. The bottom line is that it is direction, not intention, that determines our destination. That at this very moment, every single one of us is traveling on a certain road. We're traveling on a certain road morally, we're traveling on a certain road ethically, and we're traveling on a certain road spiritually. And most everybody here is old enough to understand, as you look back in your life, that sometimes one decision can determine the road that you're traveling on. And therefore, one decision that you make in your life can prove life-altering And we also know that many of those same decisions are interconnected. And so while it may just take one decision to put us on a certain pathway, that we're also making a number of other decisions that may keep us on that pathway, whether it's right or whether it's wrong. Another element to consider is the fact that the choices that we make today determine where we are going to end up tomorrow. And that's part of the problem, isn't it? That we make a decision now, but oftentimes the outcomes, the results of those choices don't come until tomorrow or at a much later point in time. But wise is the person who uses that knowledge to his or her advantage. I hope your Bibles are open. Look at what Jesus says here as he begins to close out the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 7, verse 13, Jesus says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it." Now, there's not a literal yellow brick road, but there is a road that Jesus said is going to take us to where we want to go. And if you'll notice at the end of the chapter, this is not a road that Jesus just sort of points us in the general direction of the narrow way. He doesn't leave us hanging in terms of how we can find that narrow way. He says, beginning in verse 24, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house. And yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. Then the rain fell, the floods came, the wind blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." That little parable there that Jesus tells, we often teach to our youngsters in their Bible classes, and we sort of leave out a very important component of the parable, and that is that the point of the story is that what you hear, you are looking to do. That what you learn, you are looking to perform. And Jesus says, in essence, that what he is providing for us in his words is a roadmap, if you will, in terms of how to navigate that narrow way. Tonight, I want to talk to you just about three things that will, I hope, help us to stay the course as we look to navigate our way on this narrow path, to stay on the road that's going to take us to where we want to go. The first one that I want us to look at is the need that we have to lean on the Lord. The thing that put all of us on the wrong road to begin with was a decision or a series of decisions that revealed our failure to trust and submit ourselves to God. That being on the right way is not so much about information initially as it is simply about submission, especially submission to the one who knows where every road in life is ultimately going to take us. A trust in the one who knows what is best for us, even better than we know what is best for us on our own. Now, if there was ever a man who could have relied on his own ability in regard to what roads to travel on in life, surely it would have been Solomon, wouldn't it? Because outside of Jesus, Solomon stands as the wisest man to ever live. Solomon truly was the smartest guy in the room. And as Solomon is settling into that new royal role, God communicates to him in a dream a request that is just before what Daryl read for us. And that request of God to Solomon was, "Ask whatever you wish me to give to you." In essence, the Lord gives Solomon a blank check and he says, "Fill it out." Now, let me ask you, what would you have filled in on the check when you were, not when you're 60, not when you're 45, when you're 20? What would you have filled that out? "Ask what you want from me, and I'm going to give it to you." What would you have filled out on the check? Well, Solomon, as Daryl read for us earlier, Solomon wisely recognizes that his role is king, has come from the divine hand. He sees himself as a little child. He says, I don't know how to go out or to come in verse 7. And so what he asks of God is that God provide to him an understanding heart to judge your people, to be able to discern good and evil. In short, he asks the Lord for wisdom. And God is so pleased with that request, as verse 10 tells us. And then what he goes on to say is that because Solomon asked for wisdom, and he didn't ask for all of the other things that you might have expected him to ask for, such as riches and honor, God says, I'm going to give you those as well. If there was ever a person who could be tempted to trust in his own wisdom and his own insight, it would have been Solomon. But I want you to turn over to the book of Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3, and we're going to look at a couple of verses here, because here Solomon had the wisdom to know that you don't trust in your own judgment alone. So Proverbs chapter 3, and we're going to be reading verses 5 and 6. Proverbs 3, beginning in verse 5. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Let's dissect this a little bit. Solomon says, first of all, and this is very clear, don't trust your heart. Instead, he says, trust the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean. Don't prop yourself up. Don't lean on or support yourself with your own understanding and your own insight. Instead, lean on the Lord. Trust in Him. And therefore, in Solomon's mind, what he's communicating to us is that if we view something one way and God views it a different way, we're always going to go with what God has said and not with what we think. When what we are thinking that makes sense to us doesn't correspond to what God has revealed, Solomon says, choose his way. Because oftentimes in life, our problem is we make our choices in regard to the road that we're going to travel on based on how the road looks to us right in front of us, or how it feels to us. Is it comfortable for us to travel on the road that's right in front of us? And Solomon says in very clear terms here, don't make that mistake. That in spite of all that we know or think we know, Solomon says, don't buy into the fallacy that somehow you are old enough, you are wise enough, you are smart enough, you're careful enough, you're experienced enough to rely on your own understanding. That when it comes to choosing which road we're going to travel on in life, as we evaluate our options, the place to start is with the Lord and His wisdom. Because trusting in ourselves, trusting in our own understanding, is going to take us to a place that we ultimately don't want to go to. Notice what else the smartest man in the room says. He doesn't say, acknowledge Him in some of your ways, or even in most of your ways, but in all of your ways. In every facet of life, whether we're talking about dating or marriage, whether we're talking about work or education, whether we're talking about entertainment, morality, or spirituality, in every arena of life, acknowledge Him. And when Solomon says that, he's not describing some sort of casual tip of the hat to God. He's not saying give God some obligatory shout out. This is a call to recognize who God is and what God has said, and then to respond accordingly to that. And so in this passage, the wisest man to ever live outside of Jesus calls us to recognize God's authority over every facet of our life, to not simply seek God's will, but to submit to God's will in every area of life. And you'll notice that it comes with a promise. He will make your paths, your roads, your way straight. Do you notice here that Solomon, that the promise that Solomon gives is not that God is going to straighten out whatever road you happen to choose? That's not the promise. The promise is that when we set our sights, when we're trusting in Him, when we're not leaning on our own understanding, when we're acknowledging Him in all of our ways, Psalm says you're going to be on the right road. You're going to be on the road that you want to be on. And you can trust in that. Direction, as we said, starts not so much with information, but with an attitude of submission. And tragically, this wise man Solomon doesn't just become the best example, but he also becomes one of the worst as well. Because you remember how the story of Solomon plays out. In spite of his unmatched knowledge, his incredible insight, Solomon is going to come to a place where he does not heed his own counsel in this passage. Instead, he's going to trust in his own understanding. God had very clearly said through Moses in Deuteronomy 17 and verse 17, your kings are not to multiply horses, they're not to multiply money, and they're not to multiply wives. And yet, in the very opening verse of the chapter from which Daryl read earlier, in 1 Kings chapter 3, we find that he's getting tied in with an Egyptian woman. And later, in 1 Kings chapter 11, we find that he's intermarried to a lot of other women, and ultimately will have 1,000 women at his beck and call. It was the very thing God said, don't do. And Solomon did it. It's not talent. It's not information. It's not insight that's the starting point to staying on the right road. It's a matter of submission. Leaning on the Lord, trusting in Him. Now, I'm behind here a little bit on my PowerPoint. Let's look at Solomon's wisdom and how it kind of left him. Let's talk about David, a good example. And I want you to turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel chapter 24. Just to sort of set this up, you remember that following his victory over Goliath, that David is immediately catapulted into the limelight. David becomes famous virtually overnight in the course of a single day. So much so that there are songs that are being written about him and sung about him. David is a hero in every sense of the word. The problem, however, is that the current king, a fellow by the name of Saul, is an average monarch with a much greater than average ego. And he doesn't appreciate those under his role and under his authority giving David a place of preeminence. And he's not about to be upstaged by some teenage shepherd boy. And so Saul makes it his mission to take the life of David. And that leads to a decade-long cat-and-mouse game between Saul and David. David will be hiding out in the wilderness. He'll be hiding out in the Judean hills. Saul's spy network is going to track down his location. They'll inform the king. The king will gather up his men, his soldiers, and they will take off in pursuit of David. And David will be forced to flee to yet another location. And understand, that goes on for 10 years. Of time. That's what we see here. It's Saul is back out in search of David. 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel 24 beginning in verse 1. Now when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. He came to the sheepfolds on the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. The men of David said to him, behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I am about to give you your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you. Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. It came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed. David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose and left the cave and went on his way. As the chapter opens, David or Saul and his army, they've been out, they've been in hot pursuit of the Philistines and doing battle with them. And yet, as soon as they come in, weary from the battle, Saul is so singularly focused on taking the life of David that as soon as he learns of David's whereabouts, he orders 3,000 of his soldiers to resaddle their horses, and they're going to head out after him. And in the midst of that pursuit, nature calls. That idea there of went in to relieve himself, literally covering his feet. It's a euphemism for taking care of business. And so Saul, as he's out tracking down David, has to go to the bathroom. He seeks out some royal privacy. He picks a random cave in which to do it. And yet, unbeknownst to him, David's soldiers are hiding in the inner recesses of the cave. Now, my wife and I yesterday, we went out to the Longhorn Caverns out there, and what I've learned is that you could hide in those caves very easily. In fact, if the tour guide had left us, we would have never found our way out of that place. Some people would say, well, how could, you know, David and a few hundred men hide out in a cave? It would be very easy, wouldn't it, when you've been in a cave like that? Now, in the midst of that, here's a perfect opportunity for David to take the life of the king. In conventional wisdom, this is the perfect opportunity for David to eliminate all of the hardships that he and his men have been experiencing. That by taking Saul's life, David could become what Samuel, the prophet, has already anointed him to be, and that is the king of Israel. There is also a providential aspect to this, and you'll notice that David's men are very quick to point that out. In fact, they go so far as to quote God in the process. In their minds, this is very clearly a God thing, and the signs of it, David, are everywhere. And so the pressure on David to act is intense at this moment. And yet, even though it is an emotionally charged event, David refused to be controlled by some misguided passions. The prophet Jeremiah would later write in Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 that the heart is deceitful above all else. That is, it clouds our ability to see things as they actually are. It's easy to be swayed by the emotions of a moment. It's easy to be turned by conventional wisdom or by cultural norms. It's easy to be influenced by our peers or by past patterns of our own conduct. There are times when it seems like the path of least resistance is going to be the right path to take me to where I want to go. And so surely this is the moment that David has been waiting for. David, you have entered the cave as a fugitive. You can exit this cave as a king. And yet you'll notice in the text that David exhibits remarkable restraint. And it seems to make no sense to his men. In fact, you'll notice the word in verse 7. David persuaded his men. If you have a marginal reference here, literally it's tore apart. This was not some, you know, hey, I'm not going to do that. Oh, okay. No, David was having to crush down their influence. He was having to tear apart their arguments again for this. And you'll notice that David points to some things in verse 6. He says, first of all, the Lord's forbidden that for me to do this. The Lord has forbidden me to do anything against my master. Saul is still the king, and it's still against the law to take the life of the king. This was not something David needed to pray about. This was not a subject that David needed to study about further. God had already spoken on this matter, and he had spoken very clearly about it. The second thing David points to is a principle that he has no intention of violating, and that is that he doesn't have the authority to replace what God himself has already established. And so removing Saul as king, that's not David's decision to make. That's God's decision to make, and I'm not going to be doing that, David said. The third element here is that David's refusal to kill Saul is ultimately going to be revealed to be the wise thing, isn't it? That's why it's here in the text. David had the foresight to look down the road and to understand, where is this decision going to take me? Because this moment in time is going to be told and retold to future generations. This is going to be a part of my royal legacy. Keep in mind, every road that you're on is taking you somewhere. that events are often interconnected. And David does not want the storyline of his rise to power to be predicated on a surprise attack that he makes on a vulnerable king who's taking care of business. That's not how David wants his story to be told. That's not how his rise to power, he doesn't want it to be chronicled that way. In fact, what that would have done is that would have marred his reputation forever. That would have simply declared that David was trusting in his own cunning and in his own actions rather than on the protection and the provision of God. And so in spite of all of the emotions at that moment, in spite of it having the golden appearance of a marvelous opportunity, in spite of the prompting of his men, David looks down the road and he sees, okay, if I make this decision here, what's that going to look like down there? And in his refusal to take Saul's life, David models a powerful truth that's relevant for us. And that is, you're never going to get to where you want to go by breaking God's law, by violating his principles, and by ignoring his wisdom. That when it comes to navigating the narrow way, leaning on God means that we are constantly asking ourselves three questions. Is this something that God has specifically and clearly already spoken about? Not something I need to be praying about then. It's not something I need to be studying for. God's clearly spoken on it. I know what the answer to the question is. Second of all, what's the outcome that I'm expecting? Where do I think this road is going to take me? And is it ultimately going to lead me there? And number three, is it going to tell elements of the story that I want to be told? Is this how I want the story of my life to play out? Two more points. They won't be quite as lengthy as the first. The second one is that we need to heed the right counsel. I am frequently amazed at how resistant people can be when it comes to taking advice to folks who are already where they want to be. And I'm equally amazed at how many people will borrow a page out of the playbook of somebody who's never been where they're wanting to go. Whether we're talking about marriage or whether we're talking about kids, whatever. I mean, if I want to improve my marriage, I'm going to find somebody who's already where I want to be. That's the person that I want to get my counsel from. There's a great thing about having friends, and that is most of them come from the same season of life that we are. That's why you have so much in common with them. The problem with that, however, is that your friends typically aren't any further down the road in life than what you are. And so while they may make great companions, they oftentimes make lousy counselors. Because you're taking cues from people who share your season of life. They're not any further down the road of life than what you are. And so you may be taking directions from somebody who's never been where you're wanting to go, or perhaps even worse than that, you're taking your directions from somebody who's totally lost on the way. Now, we would never think about doing that physically, would we? And yet it's a regular practice with a lot of people when it comes to other facets of life, other facets that have much greater implications on our lives than just driving in circles for an hour or two. Imagine how much better we would navigate the narrow way if we were more intentional about who we got advice from. How many dead ends could we avoid? How much regret could we eliminate? How much better would our choices be if we ignored the advice and resisted the lifestyles of those who have lost their way and instead seek counsel from those who are already where we want to be? Now, go back to the book of Proverbs. Let's go back to Solomon again, because the wisest man to ever live declares over and over and over again in the book of Proverbs the importance of seeking outside assistance, getting direction from other people. Let's start back in chapter 1. Chapter 1 and verse 5. We're just going to pick several from the book here. Proverbs 1 and verse 5. A wise man, Solomon says, will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. Chapter 11. Same book. Chapter 11, this time verse 14. chapter 11 and verse 14, where there is no guidance, the people fail, but in an abundance of counselors, there is victory. Chapter 12, verse 15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. Chapter 13, verse 10. Chapter 13, verse 10, though insolence comes nothing but strife, but wisdom is with those who receive counsel. All of those verses, and there are a host of others in the book of Proverbs, that teach a very basic principle, and that is that wise people listen and prosper as a result. Foolish people refuse to listen, and they pay the price for it. How many difficult roads could we avoid if we were simply willing to set aside our pride and to ask for some direction, to ask for some counsel? Because according to the smartest man in the room, nobody ever gets to a good place because they themselves are so smart, so insightful, so experienced that they don't need some, at some point in time, some outside input. What he says is that the wise are those who are always listening. That's how they got to be wise, and that's how they stay wise. And it's not just a case of seeking out and listening to counsel. The counsel has to come from the right kinds of people. And Solomon's son bears out the tragic folly when you don't do that. Look over at 1 Kings. Look at 1 Kings chapter 12. You remember, if you're familiar with your Bible, that following the death of Solomon, that Rehoboam becomes the king of Israel. And when he shows up at his coronation ceremony, he is approached by a disgruntled contingent of folks that are led by a man named Jeroboam. And they level their complaint against him in verse 4. 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 4. Your father made our yoke hard. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you. His daddy Solomon's aggressive building program had taken its toll on the people of Israel. They were tired from all of the effort. They were heavily taxed. What they're looking for is some relief. And they promise their loyalty to Rehoboam if Rehoboam will show them some mercy. Now, Rehoboam smartly asks for some time. Verse 5. He said to them, depart for 3 days. Then return to me. So the people departed. That was very wise on his part. You don't want to rush in and make a rash decision. And so he says, you go away for 3 days, you come back, and I'm going to tell you my answer. And here's what he does during those 3 days. He goes and he consults with the elders who served his father in verse 6. And he asks them, what is the advice that you would give to me? These were men that had a perspective that only time and life experience could provide to them. And not only that, but they are his dad's counselors, and so they have very little to gain or lose by actually telling him the truth. And they say, they're making sense. If you do what they're asking you to do, they'll serve you forever. But tragically, Rehoboam isn't looking for sound advice. What Rehoboam is wanting is affirmation. What Rehoboam is wanting is somebody who's going to tell him what he wants to hear. Someone who's going to validate what he's already decided in his own mind. And so in verse 8, he turns to his peers. He forsook the counsel of the elders, which they had given him, and consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him. Not served his dad, but served him. So he said to them, what counsel do you give that I may answer the people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father put on us? The young men grew up with him, who grew up with him, spoke to him, saying, thus you shall say to the people who spoke to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, now you make it lighter for us, but you shall speak to them, my finger, little finger, is thicker than my father's loins. Whereas my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. And of course, as the story plays out, Rehoboam's one decision results in a divided nation and ushers in a time of civil war. We talked about that. One decision, the importance of one decision. There's a couple of things we can learn from Rehoboam's mistakes. First of all, and that is that seeking counsel is only wise if you're discriminating about who you get the counsel from. Don't just get it from anybody. And second of all, even the best counsel in the world is wasted if you seek that counsel with your mind already made up. I like what one fellow said. He said, pride is hard to see in the bathroom mirror, but it's incredibly easy to see in the rearview mirror. And that would have been the case with Rehoboam, wouldn't it? The third thing that I want you to notice, and if you take notes, I'm sorry, I'm way behind on my PowerPoint tonight. I'm getting tied up in all of this and just forgetting about that part of it. Third, and finally, keep your eyes on the road. I grew up in a time when driver's ed was actually part of the high school curriculum. We got a half a credit for it, and everybody went through the classroom part, and then when everybody else was driving, you went to the library and you had a study hall, and then when you drove, you got your time to drive in the car with three other students. And I don't remember a lot about, well, at least in terms of the driving part. I remember a lot about my driver's ed teacher because he was an interesting fella. And you always went by everybody's house, and everybody's house was a ville that was attached to it. So, it would go, let's go by Trammellville. And, let's go by Greshamville. Let's go by Slackville. And that was part of his deal. One thing I do remember about driver's ed is that there was a regular focus on the need to keep your eyes where they needed to be. Because especially as young drivers, inexperienced drivers, there is a tendency for us when we were young to get focused on other things and not pay attention to where we were going. And so there was the constant refrain, keep your eyes where you're going. Keep your eyes on the road. Keep your eyes on the road. You glance in the rearview mirror, but that's all you're doing. Just a glance, see what's behind you, but your focus is on what is ahead of you. Because we tend to get distracted easily. In fact, that's become, a new term, and that's distracted driving. We didn't call it that back when I was in driver's ed. That's really what it was. But we understand, look, if you're sending a text message, you're trying to send a text message while you're driving, if you're trying to send an email while you're driving, and sometimes even if you're talking on the phone, sometimes that can distract you, and the likelihood of you being involved in an accident goes up dramatically. We said earlier that it is direction, not intention, that determines our destination. So whatever my intention is, if I'm traveling on this particular road, it's only going to take me where the road leads. Now, 29, where does 29 go from here? Llano that direction, right? Georgetown that direction? I got that right? You shake your heads because I can't look at your faces. No? Where does it go the other way? All right, I got my directions wrong. I'll put my arms down. So 29 goes to Georgetown on one side. If you go east, if you go west, goes to Llano and Mason. Okay? Does it go to Houston? What? No, it doesn't, right? The answer is no. Now, can you get there from there? That's a different question. But where does 29 take you? Does 29 take you to Houston? Does it matter how long you travel on the road? Nope. It doesn't matter. 29 takes you certain places, and it's only going to take you certain places, right? Because that's where the road runs. So if you're on 29 and you're wanting to go to Houston, there is absolutely no way for you to get to Houston unless you change the road you're on. And it doesn't matter what your intentions are. You can have the best of intentions driving on 29 about going to Houston. It doesn't matter because it is the direction you're taking that's going to determine your destination. Now, let's add one more element into that. It's what gets our attention that determines our direction and thereby ultimately decides our destination. The things that we allow to influence us influences the direction that we're heading. It helps to determine what road we're traveling on. And therefore, we can't afford to get distracted by the wrong things. We have to keep our eyes on the right road because there's only one road, Jesus says, the narrow way that's going to take us to life. Keep your eyes on the road. Stay focused on your destination. Pay attention. And inherent in that expression, there is the implication that it's going to cost us something, right? Pay attention. Look over at the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 4. One more passage. Proverbs chapter 4. Notice verse 25, if you will. Chapter 4. I'll get it right here in a minute. Like I tell the folks at home, don't turn to the passage I say. Turn to the passage that I mean. Okay? Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 25. Proverbs 4, verse 25. Notice what Solomon says here. He says, let your eyes look directly ahead and let your gaze be fixed straight in front of you. Watch the path of your feet and all your ways will be established. Do not turn to the right or to the left. Turn your foot from evil. What is Solomon saying? Solomon is saying, look, when you find the right road, stay on the road. Don't turn to the right. Don't turn to the left. Don't allow your mind or your eyes to get distracted by other things. Stay focused on where you're heading. Be alert to the distractions. Be careful what's capturing our attention. Because those are the people and those are the things that ultimately are helping to decide what road we're on. Be selective in regard to your friends. Work at the spiritual development of your family. Focus your attention on doing the things that's going to build a closer relationship with God. Folks, there is no yellow brick road. It's not quite that simple. But it's not that hard either. Because God has provided us with a divine roadmap to follow. But let's take this another step further. It's not the knowing that makes the difference. It's not the knowing that there's a roadmap. That's not going to change anything. What changes things is in the doing. It's in following the map. And so as I close tonight, I encourage all of us to choose the roads that we're on, to choose them wisely. Choose them wisely. Make sure that you're doing those things to not just start on the narrow way, but to stay on the narrow way. That you're listening to the counsel of other people in terms of how can I grow my relationship with God? That's pretty easy, isn't it? You find somebody who you see has a relationship with God that, you know what? I want what that person has. And go ask them. What can I do better? How can I develop the kind of relationship that you have? And once you get on that road, you keep your eyes on the road. You do the things that are necessary to successfully navigate that narrow road. As we close tonight, maybe you've never made the decision to travel on the narrow way. Do you remember back to what we started with in Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 and 14? Jesus said that every single one of us is on one of two roads. There's not 25 choices, there's not five choices, there's two choices. And tonight, every single one of us here is on one of two roads, just one of two. We're either on the narrow road that leads to life, or we're on the broad path that leads to destruction. And tonight, if you're not a Christian, it's pretty easy as to what road you're on. And you can change that tonight. Obey the gospel this evening. Believe and trust that Jesus is who he said that he is, that he came and he did exactly what the Father planned and what Jesus said he accomplished when he came. That he lived a perfect life. He died as a sinless sacrifice on a Roman cross. He shed his blood to pay for our sin. And that when you understand that and you come to trust that, it changes your mind. We call that repentance. In light of what he's done and the sacrifice that's been made for me, how can I do anything other than respond to the grace that he's demonstrated? We talked about that last night. And you do that by changing the direction of your life, standing before this group of people and saying, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and I want to serve him, as was done on Sunday afternoon. And then, upon that confession, be buried in water for the remission of sins, to be raised a new creature, to be born again, that you've died to the old person, you bury a dead person, but thank God we don't stay in the grave. We're raised to walk in newness of life, and you can have that tonight. Is that something that you need? You need to start down that narrow path and to navigate it carefully in such a way that we get to be in the presence of the Father when this life is over. We can help you to do that. Won't you come while together we stand and sing?